Hello and welcome to the Blue Plaque Pod. I'm here with Val McDermid, who is an award-winning Scottish novelist who has sold over 19 million books, which have been translated into more than 40 languages. She is perhaps best known for her Wire in the Blood series, featuring clinical psychologist Dr. Tony Hill, which was adapted for TV. She has also written four other series, including several standalone novels, non-fiction, short story collections, and a children's picture book called My Granny is a Pirate. Her most recent book is Past Lying. Awards include the Crime Writer Association Gold Dagger for Best Crime Novel of the Year, the Stonewall Writer of the Year, and the LA Times Book of the Year. She graduated in English from St Hilda's College, Oxford, the first from a Scottish state school to do so. Last but definitely not least, Val is the lead singer of the rock band Fun Lovin' Crime Writers. Welcome, Val.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
So this is a podcast all about blue plaques. So I was wondering if you could introduce yourself in the style of a blue plaque.
Well, my childhood home is actually across the road from where the blue plaque probably should be, in a sense, because we lived opposite the Central Library in Kirkcaldy. And that was my home from home. And that's where I discovered the joys of reading and ultimately the joys of writing. So either on my parents' home and my home and 14 Sang Road, Kirkcaldy, or Central Library, Kirkcaldy, which I say is just across the road.
Part of the challenge of a blue plaque is the brevity of the description that are given. You know, usually you can only fit maximum 19 words onto a plaque. So how would you describe yourself?
Writer, broadcaster, activist, general troublemaker.
So the fun-loving crime writers wouldn't get a mention on the blue plaque.
That's four words. I mean, that's quite a lot.
Got to be sparing. You're quite right. And lastly, would it be an official blue plaque or would you go for something a bit more decorative and unusual?
I'd be quite happy with the blue plaque because people understand what that is. Sometimes you see things, the different colours or the different designs, and you kind of think, well, is that official? Is that real? Or is it just a self-indulgence that somebody's put on a wall? So I think if I was going to have something, I would like it to be recognisably official, as it were.
So next we're going to visit the plaque that you've chosen for today's episode. And that plaque is on Castle Street in Inverness. I've been there. It's kind of on a hill that winds up from the centre towards the castle. And this is quite a wordy blue plaque. It says, site of Mackintosh Fruit Shop, family business of writer Josephine Tay, in brackets, Elizabeth Mackintosh, 1896 to 1952, author of The Daughter of Time. It was installed really recently in November 2022 by the Inverness City Heritage Trust. So I think we should sort of start by finding out a little bit more about Elizabeth Mackintosh, better known by her pen name, Josephine Tay. She was born on the 25th of July, 1896, in Inverness, and she died aged 55 in 1952 in London. She was a playwright and the author of popular detective novels, including The Franchise Affair, and her work has never been out of print since the publication of her first book over eight decades ago. She called the detective novel a medium as disciplined as any sonnet, and it was a medium she completely mastered. She's classed as one of the Golden Age crime writers alongside Agatha Christie. The Daughter of Time was voted for the best crime novel of all time by the Crime Writers Association in 1990, 40 years after her death. She also wrote plays, books, and film scripts that attracted luminaries, including Laurence Olivier, James Stewart, and Alfred Hitchcock. Can I ask why you chose this plaque?
Because I think she's a brilliant writer. And I see her as the bridge between the Golden Age and contemporary crime writing. She understood how human beings tick. And her books are all one way or another about identity and about gender. I find it quite remarkable because she was born the same year as my grandmother. And I can't imagine my grandmother writing anything that or talking about anything that deals with the subject of human relationships the way that she deals with them in her books. I first came across her when I was in my late teens. I was a student in Oxford, and round the corner from my college, there was a bookshop called Jeremy's 10p Bookshop, and all the paperbacks were 10p. And if you didn't want to keep it after you'd read it, you could take it back and trade it in and get 5p credit. And I picked Miss Pym Disposes off the shelf for no reason other than it was a crime novel, and I was reading a lot of crime fiction at the time. And I read this book, and I was amazed by it. I thought it was extraordinary. I thought the voice was extraordinary. And the story was extraordinary, and the way that she tells it was just remarkable. And I wondered why I'd never heard of this person before. Over the years, I collected the rest of her books, and I've never been disappointed yet. For me, it was a really revelatory moment because it showed me one of the things that the crime novel can do, which is to explore the intensity of human relationships and to discuss matters of identity. As I say, all her books, one way or another, deal with that issue of identity. And the more I found out about her, the more I realised that this was a kind of reflection of her own life. She had this completely dual identity. In Inverness, she was Beth McIntosh, the dutiful daughter of the fruit shop, as it were. When her mother died, she was, as the unmarried daughter, pulled out of her life as a physical education teacher to look after her father. And so in Inverness, there she was, tweed skirts, pearls, cardigans. And then every summer she would go down to London on the sleeper, and she'd get on the sleeper as Elizabeth McIntosh in her Scottish wardrobe. She'd get off the train and go to Debenham's storage, where she kept her furs and her London wardrobe, which was all beautifully tailored suits and really smart clothes, and step into her glamorous life as author Josephine Tay. And now the twain shall meet. Oh, she did this for years, and there's no record of any of her London friends ever coming to visit Inverness. It was like she had this line up the middle of her life that nobody got to cross.
It's really extraordinary, isn't it? And I, like you, I'm really struck in her books, not just by her discussions of identity, but her scalpel-sharp dissection of class and, you know, presumably of people like her. You know, she talks about, she's unsparing in her, in talks about sort of middle class people, servants below stairs, masters above stairs. You know, she talks about Gaelish speakers. She's got this incredible observation skills, but she's also pretty unsparing in her descriptions. And you know, maybe that division down the middle of her life and her stepping back, her ability to step back was part of that, her unflinching gaze.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the other thing about it, it's unflinching, but the thing that struck me about Miss Pym Dispose's that first encounter was the real wit there in those descriptions. You know, it's like, you know, you sort of find yourself with a wry smile as she sort of strips everything away from people. I think she has that extraordinary gaze. I'm not quite sure where it comes from or where she acquired it. I mean, she went from Inverness to Birmingham to study physical education at a college at Anstey in Birmingham. I suppose that must have been quite remarkable at that time, because at the early part of the 20th century, she went to the other side of the country, which was not a trivial journey, and went among strangers in a strange land almost, you know, very different from what Inverness must have been like in the 1920s. And from there, she built another life for herself. And then she had that life taken away from her when her mother died. So I guess she was constantly moving between these worlds in a kind of provisional way, almost. Nothing was permanent. She could take nothing for granted in a way, because she had these dual identities, dual lives.
Thinking about her as a master of crafting identity and stepping into and leaving them leads me to something that I wanted to talk about, which, you know, obviously, you know, blue plaques allow a glimpse into a life. And I think something that's quite interesting to do as a kind of thought experiment is to think about three pivotal moments in the life of the subject. And I'm going to choose three, and then I'm hoping that you'll choose three. Maybe they'll be the same, maybe they'll be different. But I think for me, the first one, which you've already touched on, is her return to Inverness. She makes this life for herself outside, you know, as after having excelled at school and been excellent at PE, she becomes a physical education teacher and, you know, physiotherapist for 8 years. And she lives and works in Birmingham and a few other places in England and in Scotland. She has a romance with a soldier who died fighting in the First World War. But in 1923, she returns to Inverness to care for her mother, and then when she dies, her father. And it's in Inverness that she does the bulk of her writing, you know, even at the height of her fame. And this is the sort of beginning of the divided life. And her biographer, Jennifer Morag Henderson, writes that she inhabited more than one world and lived more than one life, which I think is a very good way of putting it. The second key moment, I thought, was her choosing kind of a pen name for herself. And I sort of wanted to talk about Richard of Bordeaux, which was her most famous play, perhaps, in using the pen name of Gordon Daviot. Incidentally, it's thought that she chose that name, or chose the name Gordon, because it was the name of the man she fell in love with during the war. And as Gordon Daviot, she enjoys really pretty swift recognition. Her work was published in the Westminster Gazette and Literary Review. And then comes this play, Richard of Bordeaux, which opened in the New Theatre in London on February the 2nd, 1933. And I suppose the third thing that I wanted to pick up about her is actually sort of something that comes after her death, or perhaps a result of her death. It's just her legacy. She died of liver cancer at her sister's home in London on February the 13th, 1952. And she had purposefully not told her friends, even her London friends, of her illness, despite knowing that she was terminally ill and that she was going to die. She willed her estate, including the royalties from her books, to the National Trust. And it's fair to say, you know, you said that you came across her book sort of by accident. And I think lots of people don't really know her. She's certainly been eclipsed since her death by other Golden Age crime writers. And even, you know, I was really surprised to know that the plaque in Inverness was only installed really recently. And I suppose it makes me wonder why this was. Maybe it was her use of different pen names. Maybe it was her secretiveness during her lifetime. I wondered, you know, what you thought of that, and also what three moments you'd pick to sort of explain the enigma that is Josephine Tay.
I think the reason she kind of faded from sight for a while was that she didn't write that many books, and they weren't recognisably the same. Pick up a Miss Marple and you know pretty much the shape of what you're going to get. You pick up a Dorothy L. Sayers and you pretty much know the shape of what you're going to get. You pick up a Josephine Tay and you really don't know what you're going to get. They're different tonally, they're different in terms of subject, they're different in terms of the way she approaches the storytelling. So it was difficult for people to get a grasp on what Josephine Tay was. And I think also quite a lot of the things that she was writing about were not particularly what popular fiction wanted at the time. She was asking difficult questions about people's lives and about people's choices. And I just want to pick you up on one thing there about the mysterious soldier that she allegedly was in love with during the First World War. Nicola Upson, who's written a series of novels that feature Tay as a character, was doing her research, and she made contact with somebody who had been a friend of Josephine's, well, Beth's, since school, and was a lifelong correspondent. And she was adamant that there was no soldier, that this was a post hoc fabrication. Gordon is a common name in the Highlands, particularly the Gordon Highlanders is one of the great Highland regiments. It would have been a name that was familiar to Josephine Tay. I suspect that she may have chosen a male pseudonym because women writers had a harder time then. There was a sort of tranche of Scottish writers about that time, the sort of Neil Gunn, Hugh McDermid, a lot of them based up in the Highlands, and they had no time for her. She wasn't allowed to be part of their coterie. So I imagine that she was pretty fed up about that and wanted to be a success and adopted a male pseudonym because she thought it would give her more chance of success. And Daviot is the name of a village south of Inverness where apparently the family used to go for trips out into the country. So that's that. Hence the pseudonym. But I think she was, as I say, she was slightly to one side of the mainstream at the time. And so when publishers were pushing their agenda, if you like, she got slipped to the side.
That's really interesting. And very interesting about the supposed young man that she fell in love with, you know, whether he existed or whether he didn't, because I think people often slip in a romance because maybe that's just an easier story to tell.
I mean, he did exist in the sense that there was a person that was in her life of that name, but he was a friend. He was a fellow poet. Their relationship was that one of friendship and shared love of verse. But that's as far as it went. And I think it's convenient to paint her as one of the First World War spinsters. And I don't think it's the truth.
So if that isn't the truth, and that isn't a sort of significant turning point in her life, what are the three things that you do think would be really significant in helping people understand her life and maybe where she drew some of the inspiration for her books?
Well, I think the points that you raise are also are all very important points in her life. But I think there are other things that have equal significance. I think the fact when she left Inverness to go to Birmingham, I say that must have been a huge change in circumstance for her. going off to someplace where she didn't know anyone. You know, even the way people spoke was different. In terms of class, it was a chance for her to remake her identity by going to somewhere that nobody knew her. And so she started with a blank canvas. She could be whoever she wanted to be for these new people. And I think that was probably the first time that she actually understood that she could remake herself, that she could be someone different. And I think one of the other turning points was quite early on in her career. Her first crime novel, she entered a competition run by publishers who were looking for new crime writers. And she won that competition, which gave her the confidence to be a writer, although it was 10 years after that that she wrote her next crime novel, because in the interim, of course, there was Richard of Bordeaux, which was a life-changing moment for her. But I think there's that thing of, she wrote Richard of Bordeaux and it was this huge success. And in some ways, I think the life-changing bit came after that, because she carried on trying to write plays and they were not successful. She wrote a play about Mary, Queen of Scots, which, you know, did okay, but didn't run for very long in the West End. And after that, her plays just didn't take off at all. And she, I can understand this because I have something similar in my own background as a writer. That burning desire to tell stories, that burning desire to write. But the thing you think you're going to be good at, it turns out you're not. And so I think after the failure of building on the success of Richard of Bordeaux, she returned, I think, to the crime novel. And to separate herself from the Gordon Daviot who wrote the plays, she chose another pseudonym, and she chose her grandmother's name. Again, that allowed her to recreate herself, to separate herself from the Gordon Daviot who had the success as a playwright, so she could go on and build this other persona as the crime writer. It's a succession of selves, if you like. And I think those are... certainly for me, those are key turning points. The other thing that she got from the theatre was a group of friends. She had a close group of friends in London, people that she spent her summers with, that she went horse racing with, that she had weekends in the country with. And they were mostly queer. There was John Gielgud, Larry Olivier, Gwen Franken Davis, other people that she spent her time with, went on holiday with. Could not have been more different from the people that she was spending her time among the rest of the year in Inverness. So again, I think that's a place where she found herself.
What do you think Tay would make of the way that she's been commemorated? You know, would this be the place that she would like to put her plaque in, and is this how she would like to be remembered, even if the kind of the duality of the naming, you know, it mentions both Josephine Tay and also Elizabeth McIntosh, not Gordon Daviot, but do you think this would make her happy?
I think it might, as a sort of ultimate recognition. I mean, she was in a way a prophet without honour in her own country, and I think it's instructive that she left her estate to the National Trust of England, not to the National Trust of Scotland. Though clearly, you read her books and you see a real love for the Scottish landscape, the posthumously published Singing Sands, which is set in Scotland, and has huge, I mean, emotional attachment to that landscape that you see there. And yet, she didn't support the National Trust of Scotland in terms of her will. So I think she felt a degree of unhappiness about that. So to see herself commemorated on her native turf, I think, would have meant quite a lot to her.
You've written that you discovered Tay after reading a battered secondhand paperback of Miss Pym Disposes. You've also said that she cracked open the door for successors such as Patricia Highsmith, Ruth Rendell and Gillian Flynn, and presumably you as well. Do you feel that, you know, you're walking in her literary footsteps?
I would like to think so, but because there was that sense of she started... Her novels are, I suppose, the foundation stone of a lot of psychological crime novels, because that's where she was writing, not just about the mystery, but the psychology behind the mystery, if you like. And you know, with these kind of, any kind of new movement, it takes somebody to kick the door open a crack, and then other people go, oh yeah, we could do that. And I think that's what she did in a way. And yeah, for me, it was definitely something that opened the window, certainly opened the door for me to think that you could write a crime novel that explored human identity and human psychology. Nobody else was really doing that at the time.
So that's something about Tay that maybe has changed the way that you think about your own work. Are there elements of her life that make you think about your own life or think about your own work in a different way?
It's always convenient to pick up individual parallels. You know, I mean, I ran away to Oxford when I was 17, other end of the country, to people who spoke differently and thought differently, and that allowed me to remake myself. So I suppose in that sense, I see her as a kind of forerunner, someone who made the escape before I did, certainly. And as I referred to earlier, this sort of starting off as a playwright by accident, almost in my case, and failing ultimately before I decided to go back to my first love of crime fiction. But I think we're very different kinds of people. I don't think she would have liked me very much. She was very private. She never gave interviews. She hated having her photograph taken. It was always a sort of running battle with her publishers for new publicity photos. I don't know. I mean, she clearly had good friends that were very important to her, but they were in a box. That's not how I live my life.
Yeah, she seemed to thrive on a degree of separation from different parts of her life. That seemed to be something that she needed, or the way that she liked things setting up. And when you spoke at the beginning about her sort of taking the train, you know, from Inverness down to London and going to get her clothes, her London wardrobe out of cold storage, it's a bit sort of like a superhero changing in a telephone box.
Exactly that, yeah. But the other thing that, I mean, she was clearly a prolific letter writer. From what we do know, and from what some of her friends have still kept, she was clearly a prolific letter writer, and almost none of this remains. And I wonder if one of the things she did with that last month when she knew she was dying was to destroy a lot of her personal papers, because there's a lot that you would expect there to be in an archive that doesn't exist. So, I mean, who knows what there might have been that she didn't want the world to see. She was determined, I think, to the end, to maintain her privacy and not let people inside.
That's difficult for a writer, you know, particularly a successful writer. People want to be allowed in. And also, the act of writing means that you are exposing a part of yourself. So a very uneasy mix for her, presumably.
I think so. And I think it was important to her right up to the end to maintain that separation. You know, there she was, staying with her sister in the home counties, an hour away from her closest friends who she'd been close with for years, and didn't see any of them, didn't tell any of them what she was going through. That really is taking private person to extreme limits, I think. All these people who've shared your passions and your fun and your emotions, and you just cut them off. You don't tell them what's going on in your life.
It must have been incredibly hurtful for them, actually. I wonder if it affected how they felt about her, or whether they understood her need to be private.
I think if you were her friend, you had to understand that, because there was this thing of she'd come down to London for a few weeks and then she'd go away. I would imagine over the years, I mean, I can't imagine that none of them didn't say, oh, I'm coming up to Aberdeen to appear at the theatre there, I could pop over to Inverness. And she must have said, no, don't. You know, or I'll come to Aberdeen and see you. But she wouldn't have had the right wardrobe.
You wouldn't have recognised her as her alter ego. So maybe she wouldn't have wanted to be commemorated. Maybe she would have preferred her privacy.
Well, I think she would like to have been recognised. I think there's various points, as I say, where it's quite clear that what she wanted was to be recognised as a writer, to be recognised for someone who had made a life with words. And I think that it's not intruding on her privacy now, because you know, it's not like they're going to stake out the former fruit shop in the hope that she'll emerge. Wouldn't that be amazing, though? That was another thing you mentioned there, that Daughter of Time had been voted the best ever crime novel. There's also another poll of Crime Writers Association members a few years ago, and people were asked, if you could have another novel by any dead crime writer, who would you choose? And they didn't choose Agatha Christie or Conan Doyle. They chose Josephine Tay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Blue Plaque Pod. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe, leave a positive rating and review, and share this episode far and wide with people you think might enjoy it. You can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Blue Plaque Pod. I'm on Instagram as at Cassia Writes and on Twitter as at Cassia Sinclair. This episode was hosted by me, Cassia Sinclair, editing and audio production by Rob Burney at Made by DBM. The theme tune is Dawning Sprite by Lincoln Davis. Coming up in season one, we've got the interior designer and hotelier Kit Kemp on two pivotal members of the Bloomsbury Group. Ian Dunt, the political journalist, talks about the philosopher, reformer and economist John Stuart Mill. And Irinosin Okoje on a tightrope walker who performed during the golden age of the circus.